Well, hello. And now we resume, and tonight complete this 13th chapter in the second book of Sri Aurobindo's magnum opus, The Life Divine, this chapter entitled Exclusive Concentration of Consciousness Force and the Ignorance. He has been explaining that ignorance is a cosmic necessity without which we cannot manifest a manifold universe or the individual evolving within the universe in the same way and achieve the same results. The real is a consciousness force which has invested within it a power of self-restriction, a power of concentration, which is tapas, that which brings the infinity of its being as it wills into a proper and confined focus. And that power of concentration can be a power of concentration within an entirety of its being that allows a certain portion of its being to plunge into its mission so completely that it can forget or ignore the rest of its being which sits behind, always present. If there is one reality, it is always omnipresent. But our consciousness can, in a sense, segregate itself from other parts of its own complete nature. And that is what ignorance is. It is a plunging of a conscious being into a deliberate focus where it looks only at this object, ignoring all the rest. And without that power, this limited universe, which is signatory of the immensity of the divine being, would be impossible. So too, the individual, as he suggests, cannot attain its immersion into and its evolution out of this presumed darkness, this ignorance lapsing into apparent nescience, unless it undergoes the same process. But that same tapas, which allows us to restrict consciousness, allows us also to achieve the same thing within our own psychological being and escape the thraldom to these limitations. In other words, to assert the inherent power of infinity and freedom of consciousness with which we came here. We abandoned it, as it were, left it above, and came here into this cosmos, and we can reclaim it. And that is, of course, the process, the power of yoga. It is tapas. In the most ancient texts, what we call yoga today was called tapas in the Rig Veda and the Upanishads, etc. So let us return to his argument now. We begin with this paragraph that starts, "That purpose for which all this exclusive concentration we call the ignorance is necessary is to trace the cycle of self-oblivion and self-discovery, for the joy of which the ignorance is assumed in nature by the secret spirit. It is not that all cosmic manifestation would otherwise become impossible, but it would be a quite different manifestation from the one in which we live. It would be confined to the higher worlds of the divine existence, or to a typal non-evolving cosmos, where each being lived in the whole light of its own law of nature, and this obverse manifestation, this evolving cycle, would be impossible. So two possibilities. If we don't allow the plunge into ignorance, we stay above in what is essentially the supramental realms, where if there is diversity, it is included in a vast and embracing unity. Not much challenge there, all is harmony. Or we could descend, indeed, into stages of, or what we call planes of existence, but each one of those would not be involved and so could not evolve. They would be like layers in a cake, one above the other, but there would be no movement between or among them. There would be no coalescence of being, no possibility of the richness of all of those planes meeting at a point, as they do here in matter. We needed this plunge into the completion of ignorance to be able to evolve completely out of matter and out of that which is even below matter, from the dark inconscience. So there's the whole quest to move from the inconscience back to the superconscience. I anticipate. What is here, the goal, would be then the eternal condition. What is here, a stage, would be the perpetuated type of existence. So, the first, the superconscient in the supermind. The second, the planar worlds. I should say planar, P-L-A-N-A-R. It is to find himself in the apparent opposites of his being and his nature that Satchit-Ananda descends into the material nescience and puts on its phenomenal ignorance as a superficial mask in which he hides himself from his own conscious energy, leaving it self-forgetful and absorbed in its works and forms. It is in those forms that the slowly awaking soul has to accept the phenomenal action of an ignorance, which is really knowledge awaking progressively out of the original nescience. And it is in the new conditions created by these workings that it has to rediscover itself and divinely transform by that light the life which is thus laboring to fulfill the purpose of its descent into the inconscience. Not to return as speedily as may be to heavens, where perfect light and joy are eternal, or to the supracosmic bliss is the object of this cosmic cycle, nor merely to repeat a purposeless round in a long and satisfactory groove of ignorance, seeking for knowledge and never finding it perfectly. In that case, the ignorance would be either an inexplicable blunder of the all-conscient, or a painful and purposeless necessity equally inexplicable, but to realize the ananda of the self in other conditions than the supracosmic, the cosmic being, and to find its heaven of joy and light even in the oppositions offered by the terms of an embodied material existence. By struggle, therefore, towards the joy of self-discovery would seem to be the true object of the birth of the soul in the human body and of the labor of the human race in the series of its cycles. So here's the true object of birth, to supervene all contradictions and find bliss in the body, born of the eternal, despite all of the vicissitudes and all of the negativing forces that combat and delay us. It's worth it. The ignorance, he says, is a necessary, though quite subordinate term, in which the universal knowledge has imposed on itself that that movement might be possible. Not a blunder and a fall, but a purposeful descent, not a curse, but a divine opportunity. To find and embody the all-delight in an intense summary of its manifoldness, to achieve a possibility of the infinite existence which could not be achieved in other conditions, to create out of matter a temple of the divinity, would seem to be the task imposed on the spirit born into the material universe. Where can you read such language? The ignorance we see is not in the secret soul, but in the apparent prakriti. Nor does it belong to the whole of that prakriti. It cannot, for prakriti is the action of the all-conscient, but arises in some development from its original integrality of light and power. Where does that development take place? In what principle of being does it find its opportunity and starting point? So, where does the ignorance begin? It doesn't start in the soul. And it's not really part of the whole of nature, because all of nature ultimately is an expression of the all-conscient, of the supreme nature. So, where does it begin? Not certainly in the infinite being, the infinite consciousness, the infinite delight, Satchit Ananda, which are the supreme planes of existence, and from which all else derives or descends into this obscurer, ambiguous manifestation. There it can have no place, not in the supermind, for in the supermind, the infinite light and power are always present even in the most finite workings, and the consciousness of unity embraces the consciousness of diversity. So in what Sri Aurobindo and the Indian tradition have named those upper planes of existence, there can be no shade of ignorance present. He continues, now he gets to it. It is on the plane of mind that this putting back of the real self-consciousness becomes possible. For mind is that power of the conscious being which differentiates and runs along the lines of differentiation with the sense of diversity prominent and characteristic, and the sense of unity behind it only, not characteristic, not the very stuff of its workings. If by any chance this supporting sense of unity could be drawn back, it is possessed by mind, not in its own separate right, but because it has the supermind behind it, because it reflects the light of the supermind, of which it is a derivative and secondary power. If a veil could fall between mind and supermind, shutting off the light of the truth, or letting it come through only in rays diffused, scattered, reflected, but with distortion and division, then the phenomenon of the ignorance would intervene. So mind has a capacity to reach up to and approach and live in the sense of unity as long as it is turned to the supermind. But if it turns away, if mind turns away from the supermind and a veil is drawn between the two, if it insists on its own separate diffusive power, then ignorance can come into being because of the resulting distortion and division. Such a veil exists, says the Upanishad, constituted by the action of mind itself. It is in overmind, a golden lid which hides the face of the supramental truth, but reflects its image. In mind, it becomes a more opaque and smoky luminous coverture. A coverture is a covering, a shelter, a disguise, that behind which something sits which is not immediately apparent. So this overmind, which is a golden lid, stands between the supermind and mind proper. So you might say, and this, by the way, is a reference to the Isha Upanishad, verse 15. It stands there as that first possibility of the ultimate result of ignorance, which only occurs really in mind. But the overmind is that first passage where the diversity gains prominence and unity is left behind. So is a potential for the emergence of ignorance. That action, he writes, is the absorbed looking downward of mind on the diversity, which is its characteristic movement, and away from the supreme unity which that diversity expresses, until it forgets altogether to remember and support itself by the unity. This is the fundamental error that mind makes. Focusing on the diversity and losing the sense of the unity. Even then, the unity supports it and makes its activities possible, but the absorbed energy is unaware of its own origin and greater real self. So this energy which gets absorbed in this way is abstracted from, or you might say extracted from, that unity in a practical sense, and no longer remembers it, cannot go back to it. Since mind forgets that from which it derived, because of absorption in the workings of formative energy, it becomes so far identified with that energy as to lose hold even on itself, to become totally oblivious in a trance of work which it still supports in its somnambulist action, but of which it is no longer aware. This is the last stage of the descent of consciousness, an abysmal sleep, a fathomless trance of consciousness, which is the profound basis of the action of material nature. So he describes here its descent into the inconscience, which is the basis of matter as it rises out as the first organization of nature. It must be remembered, however, that when we speak of a partial movement of consciousness force, absorbed in its forms and actions, in a limited field of its working, this does not imply any real division of its integrality. So there's that larger field of the consciousness force, and this is a restricted portion of it. The putting of the rest of itself behind it has only the effect of making all that rest occult, that means to say hidden, to the frontal, immediately active energy in the limited field of movement, but not of shutting it out of the field. In fact, the integral force is there, though veiled by the inconscience, and it is that integral force supported by the integral self-being, which through its frontal energy does all the work and inhabits all the forms created by the movement. It is to be noted also that in order to remove the veil of the ignorance, the conscious force of being in us uses a reverse action of its power of exclusive concentration. It quiets the frontal movement of prakriti in the individual consciousness and concentrates exclusively on the concealed inner being, on the self, or on the true inner psychic or mental or vital being, the purusha, to disclose it. But when it has done so, it need not remain in this opposite exclusiveness. It can resume its integral consciousness or a global consciousness, which includes both being of purusha and action of prakriti, the soul and its instruments, the self and the dynamisms of the self-power, atma-shakti. It can then embrace its manifestation with a larger consciousness free from the previous limitation, free from the results of nature's forgetfulness of the indwelling spirit. So this is important to note, that the integrality of the consciousness force may be likened to an ocean, and then a small bay may form, which is that restricted part of the ignorance, but always is really an extension of that ocean. The ocean has not forgotten the little bay, and the bay may recognize itself as a self-existing reality, but doesn't realize its connection back to the ocean, and yet it is connected to that larger being. And so it is with ignorance and the larger consciousness force. But what is practically true for us is this description in philosophic terms here of the process of yoga. That same power that allows ignorance to form through the consciousness focusing upon itself in extremity, that squeezes tight, that creates heat as it concentrates to form this little emblem of itself, that same power, that same tapas can be used to release us from that form. That is something that we can do within ourselves by stepping within towards the Purusha, however we conceive it. It's that conscious being supporting mind, supporting life, supporting matter. It is that conscious being which we can conceive of as the true soul, the true psyche. But as we are released from it, that doesn't mean we have to negative the creation. We can then enter into free association with mind, life, and matter, with all the vehicular apparatus, and, in a sense, move joyously, freely through the world, as we might say in Sanskrit, as jivan mukti, in a state of liberation. Living liberation. So Sri Aurobindo continues, or it may quiet, the whole working it is manifested. Concentrate on a higher level of self and nature, raise the being to it, and bring down the powers of the higher level to transform the previous manifestation. All that is so transformed is still included, but as a part of the higher dynamism and its higher values in a new and greater self-creation. So in rising to a greater level, we can bring those powers discovered of a higher nature, import them into what is our current vehicle, and transform it. And this is, of course, the greater reach of Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga. You can see where he's drawing from the integrality of all of this is still connected. We can liberate ourselves within and move with the nature that we know and live in a relative freedom. Or we can go a step even farther, rise to this greater transformative power and bring it down and apply it to this current vessel and change it so that it becomes a simulacrum of those higher realities, but here in the forms that are vivid and tangible to us. This is what can happen, he writes, when the consciousness force in our being decides to raise its evolution from the mental to the supramental level. In each case, it is tapas that is effective, but it acts in a different manner according to the thing that has to be done, according to the predetermined process, dynamism, self-deploying of the infinite. So the infinite is in charge, already has the vision, is busy executing it stage after stage through all the terms of the evolution. But still, even if this is the mechanism of the ignorance, it may be asked whether it does not remain a mystery how the all-conscient could, though in only a partial action of this conscious energy, succeed in arriving at even this superficial ignorance and inconscience. Even if it were so, it would be worthwhile to fix the exact action of this mystery, its nature, its limits, so that we may not be appalled by it and misled from the real purpose it serves and the opportunity it gives. But the mystery is a fiction of the dividing intellect, which, because it finds or creates a logical opposition between two concepts, thinks there is a real opposition of the two facts observed and therefore an impossibility of coexistence and unity between them. This ignorance is, as we have seen, really a power of the knowledge to limit itself, to concentrate itself on the work in hand, an exclusive concentration in practice, which does not prevent the full existence and working out of the whole conscious being behind, but a working in the conditions chosen and self-imposed on the nature. All conscious self-limitation is a power for its special purpose, not a weakness. All concentration is a force of conscious being, not a disability. It is true that while the supermind is capable of an integral, comprehensive, multiple, infinite self-concentration, this is dividing and limited. It is true also that it creates perverse as well as partial and, insofar, false or only half-true values of things. But we have seen the object of the limitation and of this partiality of knowledge, and the object being admitted, the power to fulfill it must be admitted also in the absolute force of the absolute being. This power of self-limitation for a particular working, instead of being incompatible with the absolute conscious force of that being, is precisely one of the powers we should expect to exist among the manifold energies of the infinite. So the infinite should have this power of self-compression for a willed objective. The absolute is not really limited by putting forth in itself a cosmos of relations. It is the natural play of its absolute being, consciousness, force, self-delight. The infinite is not limited by building up in itself an infinite series of interplaying finite phenomena. Rather, that is its natural self-expression. The one is not limited by its capacity for multiplicity, in which it enjoys variously its own being. Rather, that is part of the true description of an infinite, as opposed to a rigid, finite, and conceptual unity. The absolute, the infinite, the one. Names for the nameless. So too, the ignorance considered as a power of manifoldly self-absorbed and self-limiting concentration of the conscious being is a natural capacity of variation in his self-conscious knowledge, one of the possible poises of relation of the absolute in its manifestation, of the infinite in its series of finite workings, of the one in its self-enjoyment in the many. So the ignorance is a power of this conscious being, not a denial of it. Whether you call it an absolute or the one, the power, he writes, by self-absorption, to become unaware of the world, which yet at the same time continues in the being, is one extreme of this capacity of consciousness. The power of, by absorption in the cosmic workings, to become ignorant of the self, which all the time is carrying on those workings, is the reverse extreme. But neither really limits the integral self-aware existence of Satchit-Ananda, which is superior to these apparent oppositions. Even in their opposition, they help to express and manifest the ineffable. So this ends our look at the 13th chapter. Next time, we begin chapter 14, the origin and remedy of falsehood, error, wrong, and evil. So our examination of the power of ignorance as a compressed form of the divine's own being continues. So let's see if we can find a relevant passage from Savitri tonight to go with what we're reading here in the Life Divine. So we can turn to Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, and look in Canto 3, The Glory and the Fall of Life. Our human ignorance moves towards the truth that nescience may become omniscient. Transmuted instincts shape to divine thoughts. Thoughts house infallible immortal sight, and nature climb towards God's identity. The master of the worlds, self-made her slave, is the executor of her fantasies. She has canalized the seas of omnipotence. She has limited by her laws the illimitable. The immortal bound himself to do her works. He labors at the tasks her ignorance sets, hidden in the cape of our mortality. The worlds, the forms her goddess fancy makes, have lost their origin on unseen heights. Even severed, straying from their timeless source, even deformed, obscure, accursed, and fallen, since even fall has its perverted joy, and nothing she leaves out that serves delight, these two can to the peaks revert, or here cut out the sentence of the spirit's fall, recover their forfeited divinity. At once caught in an eternal vision's sweep, he saw her pride and splendor of high-born zones, and her regions crouching in the nether deeps. Above was a monarchy of unfallen self, beneath was the gloomy trance of the abyss, an opposite pole or dim antipodes. There were vasts of the glory of life's absolutes, all laughed in a safe immortality, and an eternal childhood of the soul, before darkness came and pain and grief were born, where all could dare to be themselves and one, and wisdom played in sinless innocence with naked freedom in truth's happy sun. There were worlds of her laughter and dreadful irony. There were fields of her taste of toil and strife and tears. Her head lay on the breast of amorous death. Sleep imitated a while extinction's peace. The light of God she has parted from his dark to test the savor of bare opposites. Here, mingling in man's heart, their tones and hues have woven his being's mutable design, his life, a forward rippling stream in time, his nature's constant fixed mobility, his soul, a moving picture's changeful film, his cosmos chaos of personality. The grand creatrix, with her cryptic touch, has turned to pathos and power, being's self-dream, made a passion play of its fathomless mystery. Fathom the mystery. Jai Ma. Namaste. Good night. Good morning.